Today, the ties between China and America are so close that some dub this the Age of Chimerica. But 40 years ago, China was a hermit kingdom, much like North Korea is today. And that was when Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's national security advisor, stepped off an airplane in Beijing and opened the relationship that now shapes the 21st century. Welcome to this discussion with Dr. Henry Kissinger, whose book On China, published by Allen Lane, is one of 10 long-listed by the Lionel Gelber Prize for Best English-Language Foreign Affairs Book of 2012. The prize, in memory of Canadian diplomat Lionel Gelber, is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation, the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, and Foreign Policy Magazine in Washington, D.C. I'm Rob Steiner, Director of the Monk School's Fellowships in Global Journalism. Look through your drawers and closets sometime today and spend just 5 minutes counting the number of things you own made in China. And while you're at it, include your mortgage. The dollars we spend or that we send China when we buy their products come back across the Pacific in the form of loans throughout our whole economy. Chinese and North American campuses, meanwhile, team with each other's students. Mandarin Chinese is a popular subject even in North American high schools, and English is de rigueur in classrooms across the PRC. All of that resulted from the relationship that Henry Kissinger helped open when he went to China secretly in 1971. His book includes a dramatic account of those missions and goes well beyond them. It's a diplomatic history rooted in the 18th century and an assessment of the relationship today. Dr. Kissinger, welcome. And let me actually start by wishing you belatedly a happy Chinese New Year. Gong Xi Fa Cai.
Thank you very much.
Let me just start by asking you where you think we are right now in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and China. And I don't just mean between the two governments, but across the board, culturally, politically, socially, where are we in the relationship? Is it a healthy relationship at the moment?
Well, it's the relationship between two great societies, both of which have the view that they represent exceptionalist values or cultural phenomena, but which operate in different time frames. Americans believe that our values are universally valid and that we have an obligation to spread them around the world in a missionary manner. The Chinese believe that their culture is universally valid, but they do not have a particular obligation to spread it, nor do they think that it is really possible to become fully Chinese if you're not born and grown up in this system. So therefore, the impact of these two societies on each other is complex. On the one hand, it is inevitable given the magnitude of the two societies. On the other, it is shaped by different perceptions. The American being very pragmatic and goal-oriented, the Chinese being more conceptual and putting events into a greater historical context. But having said all of this and considering the complexity, I think the relationship is difficult, but on the whole, in reasonably good shape.
Let me ask you, based on all of that, given the intimacy that we already have now between these two countries and these two cultures, what are the mistaken assumptions that we in the West still make about China?
The rhythm of Chinese perception is different. When you ask an American, or I guess a Canadian, when something happened, he gives you a precise date. When you ask a Chinese when something happened, he gives you a dynasty. So the Chinese assume that when a senior person speaks, it has a thought-out meaning. But Americans pay a lot of attention to social conversation. And so the dialogue sometimes leads to unexpected results. But still, I want to stress, having said all of this, this relationship has now gone on for 40 years in 8 different American administrations, with occasional crises, but they have on the whole been resolved and the relationship has developed in a positive direction.
So I'm trying to put myself then in your shoes in 1971. So that's an era when you couldn't say something as positive as that. There hadn't been a lot of, there had been no track record of a relationship between an American administration and Beijing. You couldn't pick up a book at the airport on your flight over that says, here's how you do business in China. How could you be sure that you understood, even with the best translation, what Mao was really trying, what the messages Mao was really trying to send you and President Nixon well enough to really relay them accurately to President Nixon? Were you
No, we had no idea what would happen. We took a chance. We assumed that there must have been compelling interests that induced China to reopen relationships with the United States. And we certainly had compelling interests to reopen relationships with China. Their compelling interest was the possible imminence of a Soviet attack. Our compelling interest was to broaden the scope of the American discussion from a war at a corner of Asia to the future of Asia. There were almost no relations between China and the United States at the time. That had the positive aspect that we could concentrate on the conceptual issues, so that the first few series of meetings, the president's trip to China, my various trips to China, were really designed to establish a framework from which we could turn to the more concrete issues that make up the elements of normal diplomacy.
One of the very interesting elements in how you describe those meetings is, in this book, you lay out what Zhou Enlai, the premier of China at the time, is telling you, or what Mao is telling you. Particularly what Mao is telling you is often quite elliptical. It's metaphoric. He's obscure even to a lot of his Chinese compatriots. And then you sort of translate to us, although it's in English, you translate to us what he actually meant. Given that most of your experience up to that point was not in China, how could you know what he actually meant? Where did you get that?
Well, I asked myself, first of all, by the time I met Mao, that was already in the second year of our relationship. I didn't meet him on my first trip. And I attempted to analyze why he was saying what he was saying based on many conversations I had previously had with other Chinese leaders. Now, were my judgments correct? On the whole, yes. Mm-hmm. I think I haven't heard anyone offer contrary interpretations.
When you're describing the grander conceptual framework that you're just talking about, you talk in this book about how the Chinese play Wei Qi, which a lot of us would know by its Japanese name, the game of Go, with the red and the white sort of beads that are put out on a board, whereas Western countries typically build their foreign policy around chess. What do you mean by that?
Well, the game of chess is a game whose outcome attempts to achieve total victory. The game of Wei Qi attempts to achieve a relative advantage. The game of chess has 16 pieces that are on the board when the game starts, that are then attrited during the game. The game of Wei Qi starts with a blank board with 160 pieces in the possession of each player, so that the board gets augmented as the game progresses. And it can, and so at any one point, you have to consider not only what is on the board, but what the capabilities are of your adversary, and not in terms of fixed values of the pieces, because your adversary has the option of putting its pieces anywhere where there is a free space. So it is a more complex and above all a more long-range game.
Are we learning to play Wei Qi? Are they learning to play chess? Is there something... does this make our diplomacy easier, I suppose? I mean, it sounds like this makes it sound very simple to be a Western diplomat, whereas one has to be very strategic and long-term.
Because you first have to understand, from your point of view, the complex... What is the situation that has not proved self-evident to many diplomats throughout history? So leaving aside how the Chinese view it, then we assume that there is a concept of world order that applies to every nation equally. and because of the notion of sovereignty. The notion of sovereignty never existed in Chinese history. They have seen history of a set of hierarchical relationships. Now, that does not mean that they view every event, that every event is viewed in these mechanical terms, but it explains the cultural difference, which I was trying to explain.
You told us in this book, you recount how Zhou Enlai tells you that even when our economy is developed, we still won't consider ourselves to be a superpower and we won't join in the ranks of the superpowers. What did he mean by that?
No, that's what Zhou Enlai told me.
That's right.
The Chinese took the position at that time that they were morally different from other countries, which sort of fitted in with the view of history that I described. So that even if they developed the economic and military resources in which they might be a superpower, they would never exercise that. That is not a statement that I thought would be sustained by the evolution of Chinese history. I thought once China became a very strong power, it would attempt to exercise its capacities. It would do so perhaps in a different way, less on the notion of world order, but on the notion of respect which they would be owed by the magnitude of their achievements. But the impact would still be a world policy.
Whose perspective on this, whose forecast has played out stronger, yours or Zhou Enlai's? I mean, if he's saying that China morally will never behave like a superpower, and you're pointing out that in some respects it will inevitably.
I believe that the challenge of the present period is to have these two societies, which have had historically different perspectives, interacting with each other all over the world. And they have to find an approach to dealing with this that avoids the European concept of rivalry, of the balance of power based strictly on interpretations of sovereignty, but also avoids the Chinese perception of hierarchy. So I think this is an unsolved question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kissinger. You can hear interviews with other authors longlisted for the Gelber Prize, including Neil Ferguson, Francis Fukuyama, Ezra Vogel, Frederick Kemp, Amanda Foreman, Mustafa Akyol, Sean McMeekin, Peter Thompson, and John Lewis Gaddis. All of those are available alongside a discussion with Gelber Jury Chair George Russell, Executive Editor of Fox News, at www.utoronto.ca/monk, that's M-U-N-K, /Gelber, G-E-L-B-E-R. I'm Rob Steiner, Director of the Monk School Fellowships in Global Journalism, and thank you very much for joining us.